This is an example of speech.
All our history.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at BloatedNemesis, and I have with me always and forever Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at Green_Weird, which is WYRD. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Week Thoughts, about the International Wildlife Conservation Council and the self-driving car pedestrian death, a grown-up book report on No Good Men Among the Living by Anand Gopal, and updates on hashtag embarrassing Wisconsin and the damage done to higher learning, Zimbabwean politics, vulture capitalism's effects on retail and now media, and more. Prepare to get royally revolutionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now, for some weak thoughts.
I don't wonder what profit really means. Dollars in advance from the ivory tower. Waste your life in a struggle for power. All then thus reduced to please. So fuck it, just do whatever you please. For the night commuters in Uganda, the poor crack babies in Atlanta.
All right. Welcome to Tell Me What to Think. This is Weak Thoughts. I'm Peter Elbro. I have with me Charles. Since we are a podcast, to listen to this, your payment is to subscribe and review and rate.
And like and comment. Like subscribe and comment on the appropriate channels.
And you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podcast Addict. And we put segments up on YouTube at... what is it? Tell Me What to Think podcast?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, to get into some news, the last male white rhino died.
I've been raging about that all morning.
Yeah, it's super, super Sudan. Sad. Yep, his name was Sudan. I think he was about 45. It's pretty depressing. I think there's two more females left, but that essentially means the species is just about to be extinct unless they find some sort of population of white rhinos hiding out in Wakanda or something. But that leads me into some other news from last week that I think will have conservation effects going forward. Or lack thereof. The Department of the Interior last fall set up a council that they call the International Wildlife Conservation Council, which sounds nice, right? Turns out, though, in some reporting that came out within the past couple of weeks, it's stocked full of lobbyists, a lot of them.
And professional hunters.
Yeah, and they're from the NRA and the, the Safari Club International. I think that's what it's called. And they are, pro-hunting groups. Obviously the NRA, right?
Right, they feel like rich people doing safaris is somehow contributing to conservation because of all the money that they spend on it. It's, you know, that entire equivocation of money makes right, so rich people, because they have so much money, aren't doing wrong by spending it, right?
Yeah, and, their logic is... when I read about this from their perspective, it'll say things like, well, the countries that we... do this in, so countries like Zimbabwe,
Botswana,
Tanzania,
Uganda,
yeah, They are supposed to, they say, they're supposed to spend this money on conservation. I mean, that opens up a whole bag of general government corruption around the world. So, obviously,
yeah, right.
Money doesn't always go where it's supposed to. But then
it seems never to.
Yeah. But then it also brings up the idea that that just because the money that's being spent, which is significant, is supposed to be, you know, go to that, that doesn't mean there aren't better ways to make maybe more money, or that money, or that what these people are buying is not as inherently destructive as going out and killing the biggest endangered species.
Yeah, it seems like, what was it, the members in the council have that point of pride about killing the big five?
Yeah, it's I think it's leopard, lion, elephant, rhino, and cape buffalo.
Well, maybe it's the big four now since they drove that one to extinction.
Well, no, there's still black rhinos.
I suppose.
And I think, so in one of the articles from last week, it talks about, I mean, black rhinos are not, like, everywhere. None of these animals. I mean, even, so, like, take an animal like the lion. There's enough of a population out there that I'm pretty certain you would not call the lion endangered. However, the range it is in, and elephants, I know, fit this as well. I'm not as certain about leopards and cape buffalo. But their numbers are way, way, way down from even 50 years ago, 100 years ago, much less the kind of historical range. So they're in fewer places. There's fewer of them. These populations are getting more isolated. So even though you might have kind of total enough, the populations don't breed completely uniformly across the world, obviously. You know, this national park here, this refuge there. You know, so there'd be more inbreeding, which leads to more disease, which puts the populations at more risk. It brought up that these hunters often go after the biggest, because they're trophy hunters, right?
Of course.
And so the biggest would often be, although this isn't probably completely 100% sure, but would often be the strongest, have the best genes, which, again, weakening the population. So it just makes it tenuous.
Yeah, especially in communities like elephants, where the biggest is often the community leader.
Yes.
Like, they share knowledge like humans, so killing that institutional knowledge is really devastating to them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there is a fundamental difference in the way hunting and conservation... I mean, so I'm not, like... I want to say this. I'm not 100% against hunting by any means. People have
certainly
been hunting
not.
For millennia. It's something people do.
Here in Wisconsin, it's necessary to control our out-of-control deer population.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, is that there's a fundamental difference between hunting an extremely common animal. And in the case of, like, Wisconsin, we have white-tailed deer. We just have, like, too many that they start getting diseases. But there's a fundamental difference between that and hunting that, you know, maybe it's not endangered, but at least a threatened population. Threatened being a technical term. In Africa. Even here in Wisconsin. Back to Wisconsin.
Wolves.
Wolves. There's a big difference between hunting as a pro-conservation thing when it comes to deer and hunting as a pro-conservation thing when it comes to wolves. It's different, and the effects are different, and there's totally sportsmen organizations that their efforts are very environmental. The first one that comes to mind is Trouts Unlimited. I think it's called Unlimited. I might have that term wrong. I'm pretty sure that's what it's called. But whatever. They protect trout streams, which trout streams are very vulnerable habitats that get destroyed really easily. It doesn't take much. And suddenly there's no trout left. And so they help protect those, and they do it all over the country and world. I know there's duck hunting groups that protect wetlands, which again, you know.
But it's not like these people who are big game hunters are active conservatives trying to, like,
they're active conservatives. They're not active conservationists.
Right. Active conservationists, where they're trying to, like, you know, protect wetlands or some other habitat.
Yeah. And, you know, and I don't want to paint in too broad of a brush. I mean, there might be some, but as a whole, the organizations themselves, I don't think that's their main concern. And to get back to the specifics of, we know that that's not the main concern of the NRA. There are multiple NRA members on this International Wildlife Conservation Council. The NRA is not a conservation group. Like, you can maybe occasionally make a tenuous link between hunting and conservation. Fine. And, okay. And I don't know much about the Safari Club International, though I'm kind of trying to dig into that. But not even, like, in any way, shape, or form is the NRA actively lobbying for any sort of conservation efforts.
I mean, they're suing on behalf of one of the hunters so that they can bring in, what was it, like, pieces of lion?
Yeah, and like, yeah, okay, so, so, okay, fine, you're gonna go over there, you're gonna spend money, that money might go to conservation. Fine, you're gonna hunt. You're only going to do it if you can hunt animals that are illegal to bring back here. Why don't you go fucking hunt some other big animal? Something
right,
that's legal.
Don't they have, like, or some, you know, if you want to go to Africa to hunt something there, I'm sure you could do, like, zebra or gazelle or something that they probably have a lot of.
I'm sure there are things that they can legally bring over. And so they're going, I mean, especially then the ivory stuff is what, oh, fuck, man.
Hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Can you kind of picture this, too? Like, there's a classist element going on here. In Africa, there are people... No, I think they're vile people, and a lot of them get shot and killed, and I don't shed a tear. But there are people out there who are trying to kill rhinos and elephants for their ivory to sell on the black market, right? I'm guessing a lot of those people, it's an economic move.
Of course.
But now this white guy from America or Germany or Britain comes over, pays a few hundred grand, and just gets to do it, like, in this private reserve, which is right next to the big national, you know. Like, it's such bullshit. It's such classist, elitist, maybe even racist bullshit. And speaking of classism, we have a new economic advisor. Oh, go ahead.
I'd like to point out, on the other hand of that conservatism, is that all-female group of rangers that Zimbabwe is training to interdict and stop poaching.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're training, well, like snipers and, you know, wildlife rangers have to in Africa. And my thought is that if I were in any kind of decision-making position, I would definitely dispatch, like, Green Berets and Navy SEALs to train them in the latest... unconventional warfare techniques.
Because they need that to do their job, or...
Well, yeah, they're going up against poachers who are much better resourced and organized, so, yeah.
Yeah. No, and I know that throughout, I don't know about Zimbabwe specifically, but throughout the continent, anti-poaching efforts, when resourced properly, are very successful.
Right, it usually involves community involvement, so you can get those, you know, like, the poachers obviously know a lot about the game that they poach, so if you can give them an alternative path, I don't think too many of them would continue poaching out of some ideological position.
It's been years and I don't know all the details off the top of my head, but my last semester in school, I took a geography class, and the TA grad student had done research in Ghana about bushmeat, because poaching isn't just about elephants and big game, it's also about
kind feeding of your family by hunting Brazil.
Exactly. Or even less, like monkeys and fucking weird birds and shit. They just, it's generically called just bush meat because it's just whatever you find in the bush. And they sell it at like little local markets, or they just feed their family with it. And it was an economic problem in the end. And they did make a lot of progress with lessening the problem of people hunting the bushmeat. And you know, it's all tied in. So
fascinating.
So yeah. So speaking of,
all right. Well, let's go on to conservatives always be. Yeah, well, conservatives always being on the wrong side of every issue, especially economics.
Yeah,
Larry Kudlow.
Yeah, some he's some hack economist. I mean, is he even like a trained economist, or does he just pretend? Does he just play one on TV?
I mean, he was on CNBC, but I don't know if that. Here, let me. I should have done this before. Larry Kudlow, who are you?
So he's he's noted as being pushing trickle-down economics and, like, universally lower taxes. You know, like, you kind of like that Grover Norquist, you can't raise any tax ever. Even if you lowered more spending. You know, like, it,
like
it doesn't,
he would rather take $1 in tax cuts over $10 in spending cuts because he feels that tax cuts are more efficient and... Yeah.
Yeah. And so he's pushed this across the country and to devastating effects.
Apparently he did study economics.
Okay.
And he at least has a bachelor's degree.
Okay. So at least he... he's not just, yeah, some...
He was a member of SDS at Rochester University? What?
Is that okay. Students
for a Democratic Society? Yeah.
So was he? Maybe he was like a '60s radical that kind of turned. Wouldn't be the only one.
Well, and by 1987, he was a chief economist and senior managing director at Bear Stearns.
Yeah, those baby boomers, huh? Yeah, I mean, I don't think we want to dwell on him much, but I just want to. So he's replacing.
Gary Cohn,
who was the... What's the exact position? Is it Chief Economic Advisor?
Director of the National Economic Council.
Okay, yeah. Director of the National Economic Council. And so Gary Cohn... how would you describe him in, like, a sentence?
The kind of general. Gary Cohn was a lifelong banker.
Okay.
Who, yeah, ended up in one of the highest... He was CEO of Goldman Sachs, which is, like, the top of the career ladder for that kind of position.
Yeah, and he was... I saw some people kind of call him a Democrat, but I'd push it more on, like, that kind of Wall Street Democrat.
Yeah, the centrist Democrats.
The ones who are willing to work in the Trump White House.
Right.
And this guy is further to the right... While still probably having policies that would benefit Wall Street, I would.
I mean, only Wall Street. His entire shtick seems to be, like, you know, enhancing the position of financial institutions.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the people who benefit most from these kinds of tax cuts are the ones with the most money.
Yeah. To sum up, it just seems like he's the type that Trump wants because he can throw this guy on TV every now and then to defend his bullshit positions.
He has TV experience, so he'll at least be telegenic and look at the right cameras.
Yeah. All right. Also recently, speaking of the right cameras or the wrong ones... An Uber self-driving automated car, killed a pedestrian in the past week.
In Tempe, Arizona.
I don't know. I mean, there's part of me that's super excited about automated cars, about self-driving cars. I don't like driving. I mean, I do sort of like it, but I could do without it.
To my mind, it's kind of pushing our carbon footprint in the wrong direction.
Hmm.
Like, if people want to give up their agency over their vehicles, why don't we just go towards more collective transportation options? Which, you know, inevitably have a... If we use less carbon fuel, or less fossil fuels, we can hopefully try to stave off some of the worst environmental damage from climate change. But, hey, if everybody just wants to drive their... continue to drive their own car, sure, whatever, I guess. If we're all going to go along with it, then the people who are trying to fight climate change are, yeah, just frustrating themselves.
I think that's a really good point, that if it's just about not having to drive... There are already there's already ways to do that.
It's again a classist issue because, you know, people want to be served and not have to deal with other people.
Yeah, they just want to be able to sit in their car and like read on their Kindle while they sit in traffic for an hour on their way to work. But, you know, perfectly climate controlled, they don't have to worry about. You know, crazy people. You know, the peasants.
Right, they don't have to hear about some. Them. Yeah, some no peasants are listening to some YouTube video overly loud in the seat behind them.
Yes. No, I think that's. I think that gets to the root of it. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made of. It still wouldn't. Be as much as what you're saying, which is more public transportation. But
right.
If this went well, self-driving cars, they would actually reduce the amount of traffic. And if you had less traffic, there'd be less cars. They'd be spending less time on the road per trip, which would be less than the current situation.
All right, but it's just attacking margins rather than getting at the meat of the problem.
Yeah. I mean, and then the reason we brought this up is there was a article from what's his name, Elie Mistal, about the kind of legality of this, the responsibility, the legal responsibility for this death. It hasn't happened. This is the first death, so this is kind of the first time it gets
old legal territory.
Yep, get brought up in court. He took the cynical view that. It will be the pedestrian's fault.
I mean, I'm sure Uber is right. Going to... Yeah, I mean, the person wasn't walking in a crosswalk after 10 o'clock at night. Yeah, it's going to be easy for a team of corporate lawyers to pin the blame on that. Or, in equal parts parody and satire, they could pin the blame both on the pedestrian and the person who is driving the...
Yeah.
Safety driver, or as I like to call them, the first witness to robot and human violence.
Next step, Matrix. Yeah, and I don't know. I just think it's. I mean, this stuff is. It's. How can I put this? This is not just like Google Glasses. I mean, this is something that the ball is rolling and it has momentum. It's going downhill.
Yeah, like, the big car companies are absolutely already making autonomous vehicles, and they're going to be, what, sold to fleets next year?
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what if memory serves, that was GM's plan, that they were going to be able to deliver autonomous fleet vehicles by next year.
Huh. Well, depending on how big this case gets, that might cause... I mean, not that this directly involves GM, but... there might be liability.
Tesla.
There might be liability concerns that are a roadblock, temporary probably, but a roadblock, so to speak. You know what? This is a little off topic, but you know what scene I love in a movie that's recent is in that Logan movie that came out a year or so ago, where they're getting those horses on a highway. And there's all of the self-driving semi-trucks zooming by, and they, like, barely... They're just, like, barely moving, and as there's, like, horses wandering around. Like, they don't have the... They don't have the wherewithal to significantly change their habits At least not more so than a human driver, and arguably less so. But I don't know, I thought that was a interesting scene there.
It's interesting that you point out that robots kind of suffer from the same problem that humans do over time, that long tail failure or success that they can't account for and can't really react to.
Yeah, I mean, one of the main things that would be nice about self-driving cars is if they were better than human drivers. They had significantly better reaction time. They were able to notice threats before humans could, based on maybe factors that humans don't have access to. Like, you know how you have on your car, you can bring up on your phone if you're like using Google Maps or something. You can see where there's like bad traffic ahead. It'll show like a red. It'll be like red on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if the maybe this is something they're working on. I mean, I don't know. But what if the self-driving cars had more information on what those were, or maybe more detailed, so instead of just like some broad, busy traffic pattern? I mean, I don't know where they get all this info, but probably from other cars, right? And from
phones.
From sensors on, like, stoplights, and, yeah, from smartphones.
Yeah, it's Google aggregating information from smartphones is what that traffic data is on Google Maps.
Yeah. And so, but if you could notice, so let's say, instead of something that, there'd have to be, like, an almost instantaneous turnaround in this, so that, let's say, like, an accident happened ahead. It doesn't help you if that accident happened. It doesn't help you as much if the accident happened 10 minutes ago and there's police and there's traffic disruptions. But if that happened just around the corner 30 seconds before you,
yeah,
10 seconds before you, and your car could deal with that and not have a big, like, you know, whatever they call that, where all the cars hit each other and one after another, and it turns into like a pileup, you know, like a 15-car pileup, if it
right.
would just be isolated to those two. Or like ice conditions in winter driving.
Yeah, I don't trust a robot to drive in snow.
It's they're doing all this testing in California. Do they test in Wisconsin?
I've never heard of anybody testing driving autonomous cars in inclement conditions. They're testing them in perfect conditions.
Arizona, Southern California, yeah. Could you imagine what a shit show it would be when they bring those cars that were tested there, and like they allowed someone to buy one, and they like took a road trip up to Minnesota in January?
Yeah, that's going to be that's going to lead to somebody dying. Hopefully not the person who bought the car, because obviously, if it was a GM car and the driver died, then GM would be on that settlement faster than you can say Roman Israel Esquire.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And then let's just finish up with speaking of making nice transitions today. Speaking of data processing and algorithms, Cambridge Analytica, which is a British, what would you describe them as?
They're a British data analysis company, notionally.
I was going to call them a psychological warfare company, but...
they're an information warfare company. Yeah, okay. That's a pretty good precise. Well, they were founded by Robert and Rebecca Mercer, and Steve Bannon was their CEO at one point.
And they are... I've known this for like a year, but there must have been... Is it because this whistleblower came out and confirmed a lot of these things? But
yeah, it's the whistleblower in Channel 4's reporting.
Yeah. So they're big in the news. Their dealings with Facebook, getting data from them. But I swear to God, I knew that a year and a half ago. I read that.
Yeah, everything old is new again, and the news media is reporting things that happened a year ago still.
Part of me thinks that's good, though, because it doesn't allow things to die a permanent death as easily.
Sure, but they're not reporting any, like, new developments or...
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm just saying, there's kind of like a silver lining, too. And if you can get someone on the record confirming something firsthand.
Oh, yeah, like Channel 4's undercover investigative reporting. Oh,
man. Yeah, so why don't you tell people about that?
So apparently they got the current head of Cambridge Analytics on camera saying that they would be willing to employ dirty tricks in service of their clients, such as giving them bribes, performing a honeypot trap whereby they elicit, or they get Ukrainian prostitutes, I believe is what the guy said, to...
they're very beautiful.
Yeah.
I think he said.
Have sex with clients to put them in compromising situations.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, like, Facebook's PR team must be working overtime because they are doing a massive job of keeping this away from Zuckerberg and the company in general. Because, Facebook... What happened was that a researcher apparently had access to these Facebook profiles because of a research program or project that he was conducting, and then took the data and turned it to commercial use in the service of Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah.
Which Facebook says that that was a violation of their terms of service, but apparently the only thing that they did was send a letter asking the person to confirm that they had in fact deleted all of that information that they had. Because, you know, people, once they have something, are really eager to get rid of it, especially if there's a commercial interest in keeping it.
Yeah, and then this data was used to target
and profile individual people. First, like,
profile, yeah.
Yeah, they figured out who the supporters were for the various camps in the 2016 primary campaign, and then designed propaganda and other information warfare campaigns to take advantage of the cleavages in our own society and people's, I guess, lack of familiarity with objectivity in journalism and their own inability to differentiate what's true and not.
Mm-hmm. So, the Channel 4 reporting is fascinating because it just showcases, like, the depravity of politics around the world and how there's people profiting off of this type of stuff. You know, like, not just them, but like Paul Manafort types, and there's thousands and thousands of others, I'm sure.
Right, it's a whole cottage industry of lobbying.
Yeah, and then the fact that the Trump industry would be so tied in with this group is, of course, troublesome. But the data Facebook stuff seems to me there's... So the main issues are, one, they obtained this information... Is it illegally? I don't know if I'm unclear as if it's illegal, but it's at least
it's illegal how they used it, apparently.
Okay.
Well, maybe it's not illegal, but it was against the contract in terms of service that Facebook imposed. But it does seem like as soon as anybody digs into this with any kind of, you know, legal reference book and knowledge of jurisprudence, will probably find some pretty galling felonies buried in there somewhere.
Yeah. It didn't take, Channel 4.
I mean, this seems shady and crooked because underneath it probably is extremely crooked and shady.
Yes.
This is that appearance of corruption that people are so... You know, the appearance of corruption usually means that it's, like, totally rotten underneath the surface.
So,
But getting into these data sets, it's incredibly dangerous because with all of these data breaches, we've had, half of the country's credit history is just floating out there on the internet somewhere?
Yeah.
And apparently, from reports that I've seen, like Cambridge Analytica and even the Trump campaign weren't the only ones who hoovered up, like, all of the Facebook data that they could. I'm trying to find some confirmation of this, but apparently the Clinton campaign had access to literally all of America's Facebook profiles.
This is where the I think it's tough for me, but I think people in general to parse out what's illegal, what's not, what's wrong, what isn't, like morally wrong, what isn't, because we have companies that essentially most people are fine with them doing this, though I know there's troubling aspects, that use targeted advertising, right? I mean, that's what Facebook sells. Is this
that's what Google sells, yeah.
Yeah, and that's legal, I guess.
Because they're just taking the data that they know. Well, a person, the way Facebook works is that you take an advertisement looking for a certain person, and Facebook is kind of like that man in the middle who connects you with that person. They're acting as a giant middleman for as an information brokerage.
So, is the difference here, the fundamental difference, is this Cambridge Analytica was taking the people, they weren't finding people for their message, they were finding messages for specific people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we need to change these voters to vote for Trump. How can we... I don't know, but I mean, advertising does that. Political advertising does that a lot.
Yeah, and this is why we might have to have our senior legal advisor on here, her correspondent on here, because this seems like very, very finicky cleavages in the law.
Yeah.
Let's use another vaguely similar metaphor. A person's image in public is public. Like, the information that you put on a public Facebook page is public property or public knowledge. Like, so okay, you have if somebody takes your picture in public, they're absolutely in the right. If they take your picture and use it for their own commercial advantage, that's when it gets, you know, mm-hmm. turns into something illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But with something like this, it's somebody is just taking an aggregate of all of that public facing data. Well, I guess that's actually probably what the problem is here, is that the Facebook profiles that Cambridge Analytica probably has aren't all public-facing data.
I think that's one of the issues that makes it a little bit more cut and dry about them specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then also, it's been rumored that the Russian bot advertising, well, rumored slash somewhat admitted to, that the Russian bot advertising was doing the same thing. And so then it begs the question, how were they doing it? Were they doing it through a company like Cambridge Analytica? And then what are the repercussions of that? And I don't have those answers, but I mean, I think that's another fold to this story.
As a more twisted question is, like, those people were just the only ones doing it openly. There are any number of corporations that also spend money on Facebook, and
mm-hmm.
how many of them were doing it on behalf of, you know, a different stakeholder?
Yeah, I mean, and how much of it isn't even about politics, but just as important?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know.
Thing about the Russian collusion is that they could have used any number of front companies in addition to, like, the $100,000 or so that Facebook has publicized.
Yeah.
That's just what they can openly tie to
mm-hmm.
any kind of Russian interest.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's about all I had for weak thoughts. That was a good amount. Those are a lot of weak thoughts.
Yeah, it's a lot of... that's most of our program.
We are here with a grown-up book report, a.k.a. Tell Me What to Read. And, Charles, tell us about something you were reading lately.
So I just finished up with Dark Matter, Jane Meyer's revealing look at the legal underpinnings of the War on Terror. And as a churn, I was going to go on to Dark Money, you know, the people who are profiting off mm-hmm. of it, but instead I'm reading No Good Men Among the Living by Anand Gopal. It's a book about America, the Taliban, and the war through Afghan eyes. It's a very simple summation of it from the cover. The title is a reference to a Pashtun idiom. There's no good men among the living and no bad men among the dead. Or as I like to call it, this book is the War on Terror's, or the updated Catch-22 for the War on Terror. Okay. Except no part of it is funny.
This is a fiction book, right?
No, this is a non-fiction book.
Oh, it's this, well, okay.
It's just absurd that the truth. It's just the absurdity of the truth that's okay. revealed in it. Because yeah. the book follows three different people: a educated woman from Kabul named Hila, basically warlord from Uruzgan named John Muhammad, who when 9/11 happened, he was in a Taliban jail.
Okay.
And then it also follows Akbar Ghul, who is also known as Mullah Cable among the Taliban, because he was one of the commanders in charge of fighting the Northern Alliance for the Taliban.
Okay.
And it's not just a simple war journalism piece, because it really goes into the backgrounds of these people and kind of digs down into what happened to them during the Soviet occupation and after, what drove, for instance, Akbar Ghul to become Mullah Cable.
Mm-hmm.
And what drove Hila from being basically a middle-class Afghani woman to almost the margins of Afghan society. And John Muhammad was perhaps not the most interesting, but perhaps the most illustrative of the three, because as I said, he was in a Kandahar jail on 9/11. And one of the first things that Mohammad Karzai did was break that guy out of jail.
Broke him out?
Well, rescued him from jail.
Nice.
Yeah. Not necessarily, but we'll get into that. Yeah.
This guy was a total warlord.
He was, like, because Afghan is a, like, because of, shall we say, its isolation. Economically and geographically, they depend on a patronage and access social network. So the village gets resources based on who in the village can get the ear of whoever's in power. And people like John Muhammad play that system to their own obvious advantage. And with Hamid Karzai's imprimatur, he was able to basically turn Uruzgan, a province near Kabul, into his own private fiefdom after 9/11, because he had his own private security force that he was farming off to special forces as military contractors. He was leasing land that he didn't own to the Americans for their military bases, and just generally selling drugs and weapons.
Just interrupt for a second. So Karzai was, after the American invasion, became the first president of Afghanistan. You're saying what he was doing just before the invasion. Where did Karzai come from? Like, where? How did he get to that point? Was he just like a regional power broker player? Comes from a good family.
Yeah, he's from one of the bigger tribes or clans, rather. But the book doesn't even really mention him. It just goes in on these individual personalities, because I'm sure there are books about Hamid Karzai.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering, because you're bringing him up.
That's just to show you how important this guy was.
Okay.
Like, one of his first acts is when he came back to Afghanistan was to get this guy out of jail.
Okay.
So the main takeaway that I take away from this book is that the U.S. military force that we applied to Afghanistan accomplished no humanitarian good. It's tough to see how in any of this that we were anything but like, just villains.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, there's about 10 to 15 pages of this book that just absurdly lists the backgrounds of various people that were sent to Guantanamo Bay. One of the more illustrative ones is that they captured a guy that they thought was the interior minister under the Taliban and sent him to Guantanamo Bay when they already had the guy who was the interior minister for the Taliban in Guantanamo Bay.
Okay.
But, yeah, and you can... and it also is a testament of institutional failures in leadership. At one point, there is... a special forces attack on basically parallel provincial governments. Because after 9/11, or after the Taliban left, the locals elected their own, you know, legislative council, basically, and governor and police chief. And then Jean Mohammed also appointed his own governor and police chief for the same area. And then, in the end, U.S. Special Forces ended up raiding both places and killed a bunch of people.
The people elected... you said after the Taliban left?
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the games that the warlords would... One of the games that the warlords would play is that they would take their enemies and make accusations against them, like, oh, they're Taliban, when, in fact, after 9/11, the Taliban basically fucking vanished, almost disintegrated immediately in the face of overwhelming American firepower.
Okay.
And so Jan Mohammed would take the people that were, you know, making things difficult for him and point the U.S. Special Forces at them.
Yeah.
Because that's what they were depending on locals like John Muhammad and the other warlords for intelligence and knowledge of who to act against.
Yeah, that reminds me of that story, I think, that we covered on the pod from Somalia, where they were, one group was saying the other group are, oh, those are the terrorists you're looking for, and they were just farmers. Mm-hmm. Just from a rival clan.
Yeah, it's just a huge intelligence failure that mm-hmm. kind of contradicts what the intelligence cycle. Because during this raid, like, the special forces realized, hey, there's Afghan national government flags in both of these compounds, and so they got on the phone and radioed MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, where so Special Operations and Central Command are based, and were like, what about this raid? And they were told from people in Tampa that everybody on the ground was an insurgent or a member of the Taliban, contradicting the evidence of their own eyes. And, you know, this kind of institutional failure is, yeah, as I said, contradicts the intelligence cycle, where you process information from the field, it turns it into, you analyze it, and it turns into action, but that action doesn't, yeah.
Does the book get into, like, a root cause of that, of, let's just say, that kind of failure? Is it because the mission itself was nebulous? Is it because the institutions are too big and distant? Is it just human error?
It's kind of a perfect combination of all of them. Human errors and giant systems produce, well, especially with this, the amount of resources involved can produce disproportionate results.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a special forces team raiding an Afghan village won't necessarily cost the empire very much, but that Afghan village may lose almost literally everything in the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the end of it, it's, I guess, not really funny, but a lot of the people involved end up in Guantanamo and Bagram, or the prison at Bagram Air Force Base. I'd like to say the book ends on a hopeful note. John Muhammad is killed, along with a lot of other warlords, in a series of mysterious suicide attacks. Akbar Gul ends up disappearing and ending up in Bagram. Well, actually, let me back up for 1 second. There is a parallel failure on the part of the Taliban towards the end of the book's narrative, in that Akbar Gul, like, they interdict a bus full of people, like migrant workers,
mm-hmm.
and the maybe Akbar Gul himself wasn't involved in this, but there was a case where they interdicted a bus full of people, and the people on the bus were like, we're migrant workers. But according to the Taliban, they were all recruits for the Afghan National Army. And so, you know, the Talibs on the ground actually radioed back to Pakistan, like, these guys just seem to be migrant workers. And the people in Pakistan were like, no, they are recruits for the National Army, again, contradicting the evidence of their own eyes. Like, four of them were beheaded and all of them were killed.
You know, it's interesting how atrocities on both sides of a conflict, like, you ignore your team's atrocities and then just use the other team's atrocities for propaganda purposes. But look what monsters they are! Look what they did! As you just did the same thing.
Right. It's a very terrible war, this whole process. Mm-hmm. And again, the one hopeful thing is Hila, the educated woman that the book also follows. In the course of the book, she loses her husband, who is murdered because he spoke out against John Muhammad. And her sons are injured in the same attack. Mm-hmm. And she is, as a widow, is almost pushed out to the margins of society, but because if she's educated, she's able to make inroads. Eventually, she, under the patronage of the new warlord who took after Jean Muhammad was kicked out, or brought to Kabul,
mm-hmm.
she becomes actually a member of the Afghan Senate.
Oh.
Working, again, under the patronage of the new warlord.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, the book is incredibly fascinating. It reads like a not funny but equally absurd Catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
I would highly recommend it. I think every American who wants to understand the war on terror should have to read this book or something like it.
Yeah. You know, just hearing this reminds me how we don't hear criticism of that war very much.
Mm-mm. And there's huge criticisms to be made, because at the beginning of the book, the Talibs, like, as I said, just disappeared. They were all willing to surrender and, like, work for the national government, but they were rejected and arrested and otherwise pushed out. And eventually the Taliban recoalesced.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Akbar Gul, after the invasion, after his entire unit was bombed nearly to non-existence in northern Afghanistan by American forces supporting the Northern Alliance, he actually went back to Kabul and tried to become a cop or something.
Hmm.
So yeah, our own war created the opposition that we ended up fighting. Is just after 9/11, the Taliban were apparently willing to send bin Laden to a third Muslim country immediately to face justice for 9/11.
And that didn't happen. Why? Because we were like, no, we'll get him ourselves?
Yeah. It's just a matter of pride, I imagine. Can you imagine, like, Dick Cheney and Addington being like, oh yeah, we can send him to another country. That accords with our neo-imperialist policies. Yeah, there's no way that would have happened. They needed a head on a stake.
Well, they just... And they... I don't even know if they would have explicitly known it at the time, but I think that they wanted a war against radical Muslim extremism.
Yeah, they were trying to paint the war in the broadest strokes that they could so that they could, you know, make it last for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait until the war on terror is old enough to vote.
It's getting there. All right, well, that was pretty cool. The book, again, was, what, No Good Men Among the Living?
By Anand Gopal.
Gopal. Anand Gopal. How do you spell that, in case someone's...
His name is A-N-A-N-D-G-O-P-A-L.
Mm-hmm. I guess the last name right.
Let's have some final thoughts, some updates on past stories that we've done, and as we, I think, are liking to do more and more, having an hashtag embarrassing Wisconsin story. So why don't we start with that? This past week, UW-Stevens Point, University of Wisconsin, for those not in Wisconsin, Stevens Point is a system school, as they call it here, University of Wisconsin system, which is run by the Board of Regents, is our state school system. Some other states have this where they have little campuses or even big campuses around the state. The one in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, announced a plan to cut 13 majors, and they are cutting these liberal arts majors, like English and what, history? Was that one of them?
Yeah, the full list is American Studies, Art excluding Graphic Design, English excluding English for teacher certification, French, Geography, Geoscience, German, History excluding Social Science for teacher certification, Music Literature, Philosophy, Political Science, Sociology, and Spanish.
Okay, what?
Jesus. So probably all of their foreign languages at Stevens Point, if I were to guess.
Okay, I skimmed that list earlier and just read a lot of the other article, and I wish I wouldn't have, so I could have gotten my anger out of the way earlier. How is Okay, let me back up for a second. Whew. Okay, let me keep my cool. Okay, so they are getting rid of these liberal arts majors, and their reason is that they want to focus more on, how'd you put it, job-creating majors? Practical, yeah. Technical school-type things. So that's mm-hmm. why, like, graphic design was excluded.
Right. But and teacher certifications.
Yeah, although, what did you bring up earlier about that?
What's the point of teaching English for teacher certifications if you aren't going to teach English?
Yeah, I like that. Okay. What I'm getting angry about is, how is geoscience and geography not practical? Fucking UW-Madison is expanding their geographical information systems, which you could make part of your geography curriculum.
It absolutely is in every other campus. They talked about GIS all the time when I was in school taking geography courses.
Yeah, it's like a huge thing right now. And it's like, they're not... So they're not even doing what they're trying to do well.
No.
Like, it's one thing if you're going to do this thing that's not a good idea, but then when you're just doing it poorly, it just makes everything that much worse.
And let's talk about the practical use of foreign languages.
Oh, yeah, really. Yeah, I mean, Spanish isn't useful? Are you fucking kidding me?
One of them closed, but even here in Beloit, I used to live, like, between two Hispanic grocery stores. Like, my neighbors on both sides primarily speak Spanish.
Well, I mean, and there's...
Vocationally, being able to speak Spanish to potential employees and clients and customers.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, I guess you can make the argument. Okay, fine. French, German, not as big as they used to be. I thought even when I was in high school in the late 90s, the fact that French, German, and Spanish, so excluding the Spanish, French and German were taught was a little archaic. And a little.
I mean, I took 6 years. I took 5 years of German in high school. So,
yeah, but you've gotten much more use out of your college language that you learned.
Yeah, that is true.
I mean, they're fine. There's a lot of interesting things to be learned, and you can make use of it. But it's not as in high of demand as. Okay, fine. Get rid of French and German. Are they bringing in a different language? Are they?
No, absolutely not.
Chinese or...
Or Hmong?
That would be cool. That would actually be really locally important.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, hopefully we expand social services in the next, you know, when we get rid of this governor. And
if and when we can.
And
We can hire some Hmong interpreters for all of these departments. Anyway, so yeah, I mean, I think you, both of us are pretty big fans of liberal arts education. I mean, and I mean, yes, like, focus, like, I don't even really mind that they want to focus more on more practical, technical educations. However, that should go, in my opinion, hand in hand with expanding access to higher learning.
Go on.
So, if you're going to focus more on technical things, that's at the expense of liberal arts educations, and while not increasing overall access to college, then you are forcing a generation out of academics. You're forcing them out of broad cultural and you know, just make the world a better place type learning, and just pushing them into wage slave jobs and shit. And it's one thing if we're trying to give people who don't have access to college access to that education so that they can be a vital part of the future workforce. But you're just saying, no, you people, we don't want you learning philosophy. Fuck that. Like, to me,
ethics? Come on. Yeah, how useful is that?
Yes, because the people who can afford it will still be able to go to Marquette
private
or something.
Schools, yeah.
A private school and learn it. But,
or Ripon.
Yeah, but the people who, like, it's just dividing. Like, someone who can't, you can only afford to go to UW Stevens Point, maybe people who live near Stevens Point, they can't afford to live out of the home, and they can't afford a private school, and they didn't quite have the grades for scholarships, now they're not allowed to learn philosophy. That just reeks of
classism.
Yeah, I just don't think, I mean, maybe there won't be as many jobs in the future. I know I've joked about that while in college, but you know, maybe that's the case, but that's them. I mean, give them access to the technical education, but making that the only option, no, I don't like that.
Yeah, it's terrible because not everybody is technically minded. I mean, college is really basically about figuring out what you're good at, where how you can best develop your talents in service to yourself and society in general.
Mm-hmm.
And more to the point, as a broader point, like, if okay, so you don't teach the philosophy major anymore. So when that philosophy professor, who is probably teaching like probably half the class load that he was before, leaves, is there going to be anybody left to teach it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is going to impact, you know, masters in philosophy and PhD candidates even more, because a lot of the time people would go to like a school like Stevens Point and take their 4-year degree in one of these liberal arts majors to go on to something bigger and better at a different university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that pathway is now entirely cut out.
Yeah. It's not... Oh, let's just get quick to the... those are the effects of a decision like this. Let's just quick for people who wouldn't know, to the...
the bot background context.
Yeah.
So, what was it, 2015? The Board of Regents proposed... let me get the precise number down, so I'm not... So, yeah, document 2024... or document 20-24, which lumped educational concerns together with financial ones and how public universities target academic programs for closure and lay off tenured professors. This, you know, the previous, maybe we didn't cover it on the pod, but a couple of years ago there was controversy about them cutting tenure, but this is, you know, the next logical step to that.
Mm-hmm.
The Board of Regents is trying to make up funding shortfalls and lack of, not matriculation, but lack of attendance with, you know, just cutting the bottom line or cutting their costs.
Yeah. And in general, our Governor Scott Walker has, and I think members of the legislature have had a very pro-job growth mentality about higher education in the state, and they sort of tie that sort of rhetoric in with spending cuts, or at least the threats of them, and who they're placing on the, because the governor appoints the Board of Regents, that type of talk, and that was highlighted by something that the governor claimed that they didn't do, that it was just some staffer, but that's bullshit. And a few years ago, there was a little hubbub here in the state. We have something called the Wisconsin Idea, which is about sifting and winnowing through, you know, academics and education and learning for the sake of learning, and how it makes, we can make the state and world a better place. And they wanted to add something about creating jobs into this, like, lovely century-old thing called the Wisconsin Idea.
Basically make the state's responsibility more creating jobs than improving the state of knowledge.
Yeah, and even the state itself, I mean, it can, that can happen through job growth for sure, but they were trying to almost, like, limit it to that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I kind of think, what this is. This is, it's,
yeah,
it's,
exactly.
This wasn't ordered by Walker, as far as I know. He didn't demand this happened or anything like that. But this, his rhetoric is, this is what it leads to, is, Stephen's point is limiting itself to creating jobs instead of also in creating jobs.
Right. Where's the innovation going to come from? Like, think of
not Stephen's point.
Well, in the broader economy, where is if you know, taken in the abstract, where is innovation supposed to come from if all you're teaching is, like, established job skills and established occupations? You're not giving mm-hmm. people the tools to think up, you know, new forms of commerce and new organizations which provide, you know, that innovation that the economy is supposed to use to thrive.
Yeah, I think we're getting... If I were to answer that, it would probably be getting into classism a little bit again.
Yeah, again, we just kind of circle back to classism, apparently.
Yeah, it's the theme of the episode. Shit, speaking of classism, just a quick up... I don't even think we need much to talk about here, but I don't... Well, there was reporting by Citizens for Ethics this past week about Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin spending something like $1 million on a handful of flights.
Yeah, like 8 flights.
So we talked about in our other Rotten Cabinetry episode about him taking some of these flights, but they just had a nice little story about just how much it's actually costing. And... the extent to which he's doing it, he's a son of a bitch, and so nothing earth shattering there. But I just we wanted to update on some of the cabinet members. And then you said you had something you wanted to talk about with Mad Dog Mattis.
Oh yeah, I remember when we did that Rotten Cabinetry episode. I was trying to dig into the individual corruption of the members, and at the time I couldn't find anything for James Mattis, but subsequently it was brought to my attention that he was a member of the board of directors of a company called Theranos after he left military service.
And what is Theranos?
Theranos was a biomedical company that said that they had some innovative blood testing method that would take the costs down to a fraction of what they are now. Because atomizing blood to test it is apparently a technically complicated process, as one might imagine.
Okay.
And so this company was basically a Ponzi scheme. Because they didn't have any innovative technology. I don't even think they had anybody with any life sciences chops. Yeah. It was just selling shares in a company that ultimately was producing nothing.
Ah, okay.
And again, he was a member of the board of directors of this company for a few years before he became defense secretary. And when he was in, he also directed, what was it, $100 million in spending to bring Theranos' blood testing to Afghanistan, where he was, you know, head of the Central Command, which oversees Afghanistan.
While he was a general.
Yeah. And then, of course, after he retired to a nice board of directors position. Oh. Yeah, it just seems super corrupt on its face.
Yeah. Has that company subsequently folded, or...?
No, they're still operating. The CEO had to pay like $500,000 in fines, but she admitted to no wrongdoing, and I think she's still CEO of Theranos, because she can't leave the job because she's barred for 10 years from being an officer at a publicly traded company.
I didn't know they had a punishment like that. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, that's pretty common for financial malfeasance, that if you are caught fucking up in a publicly traded company, they will keep you from being a member or being an officer of a publicly traded company for a period of time or up to and including life, which, you know, that's what felons have to suffer.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of publicly traded companies and malfeasance, in our first episode, we talked about how brick and mortar retailers were being driven into bankruptcy by what would be the term for
some might call it control fraud, but more generally by the deprivations of venture capitalism.
Venture capital, there you go. And so we talked about in that episode, I think, Sears and, was it Kmart? And
yeah, because they were part of the same conglomerate.
Yep, and Toys R Us.
Mm-hmm.
And Toys R Us, to update, filed for bankruptcy a week or two ago.
And they're putting themselves in liquidation, just cutting all of their, closing or selling all of their retail locations.
Yeah, it's crazy, so, you know. No more Toys R Us kids.
Yeah.
You know what, though? Where the hell do you go? Like, is there a store left where you can just go and look at toys?
I don't think so. I don't, hate other than online. Toys R Us, I can't even think of a toy store anywhere in the area.
In Madison, we have a couple, like, little kind of... They're not as broad with the toys, and they're more about, like, crafts and games.
Oh, yeah, and, like... Are not intellectual, but more thought-developing toy stores, like the one on State Street.
Yeah, and I think the one I'm thinking of is called, like, The Learning Shop. It's not, like, all educational, but that's what they're sort of shooting for. But, you know, where can I go to just, like, see, like, a giant shelf of Barbies or something, you know?
Yeah, or action figures or Legos.
I would imagine the toy companies are... I mean, yeah, they still have the online retailers, but... That doesn't drive sales as much. That doesn't get the kids being like, can I have this? Can I have this? Can I have this?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how they... I don't know if their stocks have gone up or down. Or anyway, we talked about that in our first episode. Also, it came out this week. And that a similar... type of scheme is happening with what was formerly known as Clear Channel Radio is now called iHeart Radio, but they just filed for bankruptcy. They were bought up by venture capitalists, including what is it called, Bain Capital,
right? Mitt Romney's company.
He's not still with it, is he?
No, he's not anymore, but... Okay.
He founded it, or helped found it.
Yeah, he's like the poster boy of venture capitalism. So if he becomes like a sitting senator or otherwise public representative, that's just not America.
Well, also, it would be... I would imagine he would be defending those practices while in office.
Right, he's not going to vote to regulate the banks more.
Yeah. And so there was a couple articles kind of tied in. I think it was like on Boing Boing and Naked Capitalism about a similar thing as occurred with retail and is occurring, happening in the tech sector. Or the media sector, I guess would be a better way to put it. And I don't know. I just thought that was pretty interesting. Like I didn't really know that this was happening with other industries.
Yeah, it's these venture capitalists have more money than sense, and they're able to take the value proposition of reorganizing and reforming business models to make them more efficient investments. But it is almost literally never gone that way. Like, okay, so I guess with media, it might be argued that if you were able to recapitalize it and make some better choices in technology than they had available to them when the radio station first came out, they, you know, might be able to save some costs, but it's really just attacking the margins.
Well, and on some level, that company did that. But they also, because of the what happened, they had more than twice the debt afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Which I don't think they were able to get out of.
Well, that's the fuck of it. It's like, I don't know why these transactions are legally allowed, because these... Okay, I get it. Like, when you buy a house, like, you're supposed to have a certain measure of equity in the house, so that, you know, you have skin in the game, for lack of a better term, but these venture capitalists, like, contribute, like, just small percentages of the finance or money necessary to buy these companies and rely on loans to buy the rest. And then they put the cost of these loans on the company's books. So, like the case with Toys R Us, there's no reason that company shouldn't be an ongoing concern other than the debt that Bain Capital put on them. The cost of servicing that debt and the interest was more than the company was able to make.
Why do the banks go for this? I was reading through
this. Because they get shares and collateral.
But it,
and they're the first ones in line when bankruptcy happens.
Yeah, okay. So they will get paid off.
Yeah, they're exploiting bankruptcy law, because this company can go under, all the employees can lose their jobs, it can all get liquidated, but the banks, because they hold these loans, will be the first people in line to collect.
But isn't there a chance that they won't get all of their money?
Maybe, but the debt service payments that are made before the bankruptcy are usually enough to offset that.
That's what it is, okay.
Because it's not like they go bankrupt immediately, they go bankrupt after a couple of years of trying to service this enormous mountain of debt that they're under.
Okay.
Which, again, I don't understand why this is legal. I mean, I know why this is legal, but it doesn't make it any more comprehensible why somebody looked at this and thought it was a good idea.
I don't have a really a good answer. I mean, it's not like... I mean, I guess... What were you going to say when you're like, I know why it's legal? Is it because the banking industry has political power?
Right, because the people with money have the money to write the laws, and the legal experts who are willing to go along and, I mean, not write anything, because notionally lawyers are supposed to be ethical and responsible people who service their clients, but or serve in the best interests of their clients. But, you know, that's, for instance, with the iHeartRadio, like, there's no reason that company should be allowed to exist. Media consolidation has obviously gone way beyond what anybody ever thought was reasonable. And they own, like, what, 70% of the radio stations across 70% of this country?
They did. They sold a bunch of them off. I don't know who bought them. I don't know if they were all bought up at once or what. But
that kind of consolidation should never have been legal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and it's like a Shakespearean tragedy with this company. Like,
they can do no right. I mean, they're buying up all these companies that they shouldn't be allowed to do. In the process, though, they go into so much debt that they're then vulnerable to be bought out. They're then bought out, and more debt is put on their books. And then they try to expand, and they keep putting more debt, and then they just have to file for bankruptcy. I mean, nothing happened that worked out for them.
No.
Or like, well, except for the few individuals who profited.
Right, the people who were able to put that huge amount of debt on the ledger.
All right. Well,
Speaking about having leftover debt on the ledger, I'd like to bring up Zimbabwe.
Oh, yeah, that's Zimbabwe. Yep, sorry.
Apparently, President Mnangagwa decided to cut the rolls for the government of Zimbabwe, because apparently the Blue Mansion, the residence of former President Robert Mugabe, all of the workers who worked at the Blue Mansion and one of the associated farms were government employees. And President Mnangagwa has fired all of them and taken them off the government's payroll.
Huh.
And apparently they're looking at July elections, I heard.
Okay. What?
Mugabe's rearing his head again because he was in interviews over the past couple of weeks with blasting the new president. Like, he doesn't know why he... Yeah. Mugabe was lamenting the fact that he allowed Mnangagwa to become who he was, or who he is now, ultimately.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's bitter.
Yeah, and they reorganized, the National Unity Party. They formed their own political plank to fight in the election, or to
Mugabe?
Contest the elections, yeah.
Wow.
Mugabe and his wife Grace are formed their own political party.
Are they in Zimbabwe right now?
Yeah, he's still living at that house, that mansion that was just recently serviced by government employees.
Okay. Well, I mean, not that I... how can I say this? I just find it surprising that the country... I mean, he's just popular, right? He's still popular. Isn't he?
No, I don't think he was ever really... He hasn't been popular since probably liberation, really.
He's popular enough to have spared his life and kept him in the country. I mean, that's unusual for a guy who was running, you know.
Yeah, I suppose that is true. Dictators normally go to third country exiles.
Yeah.
He's like Idi Amin.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Okay. Well, keep
I just
eye.
Wish that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wish there were more than the choice between the guy who overthrew the government with a military coup, well, a bloodless military coup, and the guy who ran the country into the ground. There should be more options for Zimbabwe than that.
Well, why? I mean, they've had more than that in past elections. They just rigged the elections, right?
Right, but the leader for the movement of. For democratic change, Morgan Tsvangirai died about a month after the coup, so there's virtually no unified opposition anymore either.
Okay.
And, yeah.
Alright, well...
So we'll see what happens in July.
Okay. We will keep an eye on that. We'll keep an eye on other stories that we've touched on over the past few months. Remember to... like and press the bell and check marks and
subscribe, comment,
yep.
And please let us know what you think, or
yeah,
please tell us how we're wrong.
Yes. I dare you to
come at me, bro.
We are you can email the podcast at tmwttpod@gmail.com. you can contact me on Twitter at bloatednemesis. You can contact Charles on Twitter at @green_weird, which is WYRD. And, yeah, that's it for the podcast. This has been Tell Me What to Think. Thank you all for listening. It's been
good
fun.
Night and good luck.
Good luck. Good night. Have a fun weekend and week. Work hard, wake up early, go to bed early. I don't know, whatever other.
Don't forget to exercise.
Eat your apples, fruit and vegetables, and greens.
And 8 cups of water a day.
All right, bye.
Days are sunny, days are rain. Destroy the myth that will break our chains. Break your chains.